Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the Thursday edition here at Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin with us both hours for open forum, and you know the phones will be busy, so I'll give out the number, but you better start dialing if you want to get through. As a matter of fact, I see already some folks on the line. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Open forum is for everyone and anyone. Yeah, you don't have to be Catholic to call. You don't have to be Christian to call. Anybody can call with a question. When Jimmy's here, in particular, open forum means really open. If you've got questions having to do with the Catholic faith, the practice of the Catholic faith, the Bible, or Christianity more generally, or the religious life more generally, or God, or morals, or science, or it's pretty open. We don't refuse very many calls when Jimmy's here. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, and the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, among many other books. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Howdy, how's it going, Psychelet?
It's going very, very well. I'm feeling in the mood for some groovy music today, so I'm hoping that Nick is on top of that. And I'm curious about what is dropping on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World tomorrow.
Well, back in the 1950s, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover started an illegal counterintelligence program that ended up killing people. And by the 1970s, this was starting to become a little obvious to the public. And so in 1971, a group of concerned citizens decided to take matters into their own hands and burgle the FBI to get the proof. And they did. And so we're going to be telling about the mystery of what happened with them and eventually how we learned who they were.
Burgled the FBI. Just right off the top, that does not sound like a good idea. But they were, I guess, they were pros, huh? They knew what they were doing.
They prepared and they got away with it. The FBI walked into their office one morning in Media, Pennsylvania, and found all their files gone.
Wow. All right. So, what number issue is this? We must be up to about 110 or something.
Yeah, right? It's around 110. I was just prepping an outline last night for 113. So we're well over 100 now.
Nice. Okay. So so what's this one called? What's the title? What should I look for?
Daring FBI burglary or FBI secrets exposed, something like that. It's going to be a two-parter, by the way.
Very good. Okay. Yeah, this sounds like it needs to be a two-parter. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, a very popular podcast for anybody who is interested. That's all, interested. I don't even have to say what you're interested in, because it is eclectic. It is broad. It covers all kinds of things. So if you are capable of being interested, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is the podcast for you. Right now, lines already full. 888-318-7884, the number. So as we get deal with questions and answers, you can dial and try to get in there. But lines already full. So I think I will go to calls. Jimmy, all right?
Okay.
All right, let's start with Eric in Indio. Oh, Indio, right here in California, watching on YouTube Live. Eric in Indio, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. My name is Eric Lemming. I was born and raised as a Roman Catholic, and my question for Jimmy is Matthew chapter 24, verse 24 says, "For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform signs and wonders so great that they would deceive even God's chosen people. If that were possible, what does that mean?"
Well, so the first place to start with any text in the Bible is what was the author of the Bible trying to communicate by saying this? And this is especially important in prophetic texts, because prophecies often have a main fulfillment in one period of history, but then they also can apply to later periods of history as well. In this case, if you study the parallel texts in Mark 13 and in Luke 21, this is part of a speech that Jesus gives on the Mount of Olives. It's called the Olivet Discourse. And in all three of the presentations of the Olivet Discourse, it's triggered when Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which happened in AD 70. And so the disciples come to Jesus and they say, well, tell us more about that. How is it going to happen that the temple is going to be destroyed? And what signs should we look for that the temple is about to be destroyed? And so that points us to the period between when Jesus was saying this in AD 33 and then when the temple actually was destroyed in AD 70. And so one of the signs that Jesus is predicting that will happen before the destruction of the temple is that there would be false Christs, meaning people who claim to be the Messiah even though they weren't, and also false prophets. And they would declare various signs, some of which would seem to come true, and that they would have a deceptive power and be able to get people to follow them. And actually, from the historical record, we know that happened. There were people who presented themselves as, I'm the Messiah. There were other people who presented themselves as prophets who were going to do miraculous signs. And they got followings that you know they led around and that ultimately they led into disaster. So that's the basic meaning of what happened here. Now, one thing that many people will notice is that Jesus, he doesn't say they will deceive God's chosen people or God's elect. In other translations, it'll say elect. And they wondered about that. And, you know, how could the elect be deceived? In later theological vocabulary, later theologians began to use the word elect to mean those people who will be saved on the last day. But that's not actually how it's commonly used in Scripture. In fact, I did a study of this subject a while back, and I actually published a little ebook about it. You can find it on Amazon. It's called Chosen by God. So just look for Chosen by God by Jimmy Akin. And I actually go through the Bible and the early church fathers and survey how they talk about the elect. And the overwhelming use of this term is to just mean either Jews or Christians, just people who are part of God's chosen people, Israel, or people who are part of God's chosen people, the church. And that's what seems to be occurring in this passage. What Jesus is saying is that these false messiahs and false prophets will, some of them will perform amazing wonders falsely, and some of them will be impressive enough that, or at least they will try to, deceive even Christians. So we're not talking about they're going to deceive people who will be saved on the last day, but just there are some ordinary Christians who might be deceived by these people. And so they need to know about these false Christs and false messiahs and false prophets so that they'll be on their guard against them. So having said all that about the first century, I should mention that because prophecies can have more than one fulfillment, it's also possible that before the end of the world, we'll see more false messiahs and false prophets. We've certainly seen them down through the centuries. A variety of them have appeared down through the centuries and continue to appear today. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there are quite a number of notable ones who will appear before the end of the world.
And as I said, Eric, the lines are quite full, so I'm going to probably keep moving today. But thank you so much for the call. I hope that was helpful to you. Matt in Maryland, also watching on YouTube Live, you are next. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello.
Hi, Matt.
Just have a quick question. Hello. A couple of friends and I started a conversation the other day about the binding of Isaac, and I know mm-hmm. that the standard interpretation of this is that Abraham definitely believed he was going to go ahead and sacrifice Isaac, but there seem to be little bits within Genesis that might suggest otherwise. For example, you know, Abraham seems to say that he and Isaac would return before he ever goes up the mountain, and then there's a promise earlier in Genesis talking about how more or less, you know, Abraham's spiritual descendancy would be traced through Isaac. And so I guess the question really is, you know, is it possible to interpret this passage as if Abraham didn't really believe he was going to commit that sacrifice before he went up and what the implications of that would be? I know that there's some Jewish writers to take that position, and I guess the passage in Hebrews would need some reinterpretation in light of that too, but just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, it's certainly possible to interpret it that way. Now, you know, one way to interpret Abraham's remark that the boy and I are going to go up on the mountain and then we're going to come back is he's just saying that to keep the servants from following them, that he really did expect to sacrifice Isaac and for Isaac to die. But it can also be read another way. It can be read as, well, somehow Isaac's going to come back with me. And that would enable Isaac to be the son of promise through whom Abraham's descendants will be reckoned, because Isaac needs to survive in order to have more children so Abraham can have descendants through Isaac. And that seems to be the interpretation that's offered by the author of Hebrews, because in Hebrews, the author talks about how Abraham considered God able to raise the dead. And so on the interpretation that's at least suggested by the author of Hebrews, Abraham was planning to go up on the mountain with Isaac, and he was planning on sacrificing Isaac, so Isaac would die. But then Abraham expected that God would raise Isaac from the dead, and so he would come back down, and they'd be reunited with the servants, and then also Isaac would be able to go on in life to have children, which would be the line of promise that God had promised to Abraham. So that's certainly a possible interpretation.
All right. I guess that satisfied Matt. All right. Thank you, Matt. Thanks very much. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It is Open Forum today. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Hi, this is Cy. This week on our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, spend some time with two very different saints. Father Hugh Barber shares the inspiring story of St. Mark Zhi Chang Zhang, who lived more than 30 years as an opium addict. And though he never overcame his addiction, he died a martyr's death. And then author and scholar Robert Senkiewicz sets the record straight on St. Junipero Serra and the treatment of Native American people right here in California. Catholic Answers Focus is free and available wherever you get your podcasts, or visit us at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Ever wonder about the power of prayer? St. John Chrysostom states that prayer and converse with God is a supreme good. It is a partnership and union with God. As the eyes of the body are enlightened when they see light, so our spirit, when it is intent on God through prayer, is illumined by His infinite light. Let God's infinite light be your guiding light. Ask Him to guide you daily in your prayer, work, recreation, home life with family, and your friendships.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. I think there's one line open, so you can try 888-318-7884. But because volume is high, we're going to just keep moving through questions. Aaron in Tampa, Florida is next. Also watching on YouTube Live, Aaron, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a question on the Catholic perspective of the land promises to the Jews, because I know in Jeremiah 32 and 33, there were a lot of promises made, and it doesn't seem to me that those promises have been fulfilled yet, because it says that, you know, all 12 tribes will be restored, and it doesn't seem to me like those were fulfilled either during the Second Temple period or now. I think even today, the Jews would still need land that's currently being held by Syria and Egypt. So I was wondering if you could get me, what's the perspective on that? Is that going to happen in the future, or has that bit promise been canceled? Is it null and void?
Okay. So what I can tell you is that the Catholic Church does not have an official interpretation on this matter. In fact, after the refounding of the State of Israel in 1948, if you look at church documents dealing with Israel, they have been studiously silent on the issue of those promises and should we expect them to be fulfilled? And if we should expect them to be fulfilled, does that correspond to the modern nation state of Israel? So the church has no official perspective on that. It therefore falls to the individual interpreter to try to make sense of the prophetic data as best the interpreter can. And there have been a lot of different proposals. On the one hand, you have some folks, and this is especially common in certain Protestant circles, and by no means all Protestant circles, but in certain Protestant circles, to say, well, those promises are absolutely literal and they will be fulfilled in the future. And the current state of Israel is like a little partial fulfillment of those. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, you have people who would say, no, those promises, you know, one of the things Jeremiah does in his prophetic book, in his main prophetic book, the book of Jeremiah, is say, if God ever promises to build and plant a country, but that country doesn't repent, then he's going to cancel that promise because of their non-repentance. And so other people have looked at this and said, well, when corporately, at least, we're not talking about every individual Jew because the apostles themselves were Jews, but when the state of Israel corporately refused to repent and corporately did not embrace the Messiah that God sent to them, all of those promises got canceled. Then there are some additional views. Some of them would, that are kind of in the middle, some of them would say, well, when prophecy gets fulfilled, it's often in an unexpected way that you know, because prophecy involves symbolism, it's often an unexpected type of fulfillment. And so these promises have been fulfilled, but in a spiritual sense rather than in a crudely literal sense. So rather than inheriting a specific piece of land, God's people have inherited a spiritual homeland. And that's true both of Jewish believers and of Gentile believers. They've become the new Israel of God, which has a spiritual homeland. And that applies also, according to some variations on this view, to the 10 northern tribes, because we know where those 10 northern tribes went. We're told in the Old Testament where they went, and it's regions that are in modern Iraq and Iran. Well, those areas ended up having a lot of Christians in them. They ended up having the gospel preached to them, and lots of people became Christian. Now, today, they're majority Muslim, but even today, there are Christians who are from there. We have, over the years at Catholic Answers, and even now, we've had folks who are employees of Catholic Answers who descend from people living in that area in northern Iraq. And so it's possible that some of them are descendants of the missing tribes and that they did return to God spiritually through evangelization and through the embrace of the gospel. So there are a variety of different perspectives on all that. If you would like to learn more about the 10 northern tribes specifically, check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I've got an episode on the 10 lost tribes, and it goes into the different arguments for different positions.
All right. I'm going to leave it there, Aaron. As I said, lots of folks on the line for Jimmy. I hope that was helpful for you. 888-318-7884, the number. Jerry in Buffalo, New York, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Jerry, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Well, some of this started to be talked about a little bit, and I have relatives on my mom's side that were Jewish, even though I was raised Catholic. And, you know, the question always comes up, why aren't the Jewish holidays still celebrated, because the Lord had said to continue those, and up to the almost like second century, early believers did, and then it dropped off. So I didn't know if that was because there were more Gentile believers than Jewish believers, so I'm just trying to reconcile all that.
Okay. Well, so we actually, you've already hit on part of the answer. Part of the answer is that in the earliest decades of the church, the majority of believers were Jewish Christians. And so being Jews, they naturally kept the various holy days that Jews were accustomed to keeping. But it was also made clear that that wasn't necessary for Gentiles. Now, partly everybody already knew that because the Jewish law that prescribed many of these festivals, not all of them, but many of them, was only ever binding on the Jewish people. It was understood if you were a Jew, then you needed to keep kosher and you needed to keep the Passover and you needed to keep tabernacles and things like that. But if you were a Greek, you didn't need to do any of those things. Your forefathers had not made a covenant with God where they agreed to do those things. You were not a people that had been delivered out of Egypt, and so there was no reason for you to keep a feast about your ancestors' deliverance out of Egypt. So you had no reason to keep Passover. Your ancestors never spent time in the wilderness before entering them in the promised land, and so there was no reason to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And so the Jewish law was only ever binding on the Jewish people. Now, there became a question in the early church about, well, do Gentiles need to become Jews in order to be Christians? And if they did need to become Jews in order to become Christians, then, well, then they would need to keep those festivals. But St. Paul addresses this, and he makes the point, you can find it, for example, in Colossians chapter 2, but he makes the point that those all of the different Old Testament ceremonies, not just the feast days, but other things too, were shadows that pointed forward to Christ. But once the substance of Christ arrived, we no longer need the shadows. And so Christ, St. Paul says, was the end of the law in that we don't need to keep those various ceremonial requirements anymore, not even Jews. He himself did not, at least not when he was dealing with Gentiles. But he goes even further and talks about how we should not let anybody judge us in food or in drink or in whether we keep a Sabbath or a new moon or a feast day. And the Sabbaths, which occurred weekly, and the new moons, which occurred monthly, and the feast days, which occurred annually, were the three kinds of holy days on the Jewish calendar. So St. Paul is clear that that we Christians are not obliged to keep those holy days anymore. And as the number of Gentile Christians grew, naturally the number of people who didn't traditionally keep those feast days also grew because, you know, I mean, my ancestors came from the British Isles and they weren't delivered from Egypt and they didn't spend time in the wilderness. But since I'm a Christian, I actually keep an equivalent of one of those, which is Easter. Easter is connected. Easter is sort of the Christian equivalent of Passover. It celebrates what Jesus did for us as the fulfillment of the Passover lamb, and that does apply to Christians. So as a Christian, I keep Easter, but I don't keep Passover. And I similarly keep other feasts that were instituted for Christians, but because I'm not Jewish, I don't keep Jewish feasts.
Okay.
All right.
I know some people, as Christians, do still celebrate Passover, but with the Messiah, fulfillment with the Messiah. So, all right.
And that could be a little problematic because Christ is our Passover, as St. Paul says. So it can be problematic to say we need to keep an altered version of Passover that's different from the one that that is directly about Jesus and. There have been different attitudes taken towards that in church history, but prevailingly the attitude has been one of we should respect Jewish customs and not try to hybridize them with our customs. We should let Jewish people have their own customs and us as Christians have our own celebrations.
Thank you, Jerry. Let's go to Walt in Midland, Texas. Walt, you there with us?
Yes. Thank you for taking call. I wanted to say, Jimmy, I wanted to thank you for all that you've done. You've helped me a lot in these past few months, really regain and a grasp on my Catholicism that I was lukewarm in the past years. I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
My question is, so I want to give like a hypothetical situation. regarding someone who is a nurse practitioner and who owns their own clinic. And, you know, this nurse practitioner has patients. This person believes that birth control is wrong and is a Catholic. However, what does this person do as a nurse practitioner in a situation where they do not want to deny someone if a patient would ask for birth control or any form of contraception? I mean, what does this person do? Does this person avoid it completely or only, you know, prescribe it or administer the shot in certain situations? Or I guess, you know, just a basic question would be, how does one keep in the morality with the church regarding this?
Okay. Walt, if you can, please just hang on. So after the break, and Jimmy will get back to your question, because you can probably hear the music. We got to take a quick break. Catholic Answers Live. It's warm. Jimmy Akin, our guest today. More of that right after this.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team discusses the Little Sisters of the Poor's win at the Supreme Court.
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and Walt in Midland, Texas, called with a question about prescribing contraception as a nurse practitioner. Walt, sorry we had to ask you to wait, but thank you for waiting. Jimmy, did you want to tackle that?
The subject of this subject, it has a lot of complexity to it, because even though the church has been firm that married couples cannot use contraception, there are fringe cases where, and they can't ever use contraception, meaning contraception properly so-called. However, if they're using what would ordinarily be contraceptive, like a set of hormones, for some other medical purpose, not in order to block conception from taking place, but for some other legitimate medical purpose, then that can be legitimate, because, and in that case, they're not using contraception. They're using hormones to achieve some other purpose, and the hormones just as a side effect happen to block conception, but they're not being used to block conception. Also, there are things that are sometimes called like emergency contraception, where if someone has been raped and so they haven't themselves consented to a sexual act, there are things that can be done legitimately according to the various Catholic moral experts who are thoroughly Orthodox who've looked at this. There are things that can be done to stop an involuntary conception from taking place, where someone has been violated and this is viewed as an act of defense against further violation rather than a frustration of the marital act between a husband and a wife. And, you know, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has issued some guidelines regarding that. What I would suggest for anyone for whom this is a practical issue, like one that they're that they may be confronted with in their actual work environment, is go to the experts. Contact the National Catholic Bioethics Center. They have a website. It's NCB Center for National Catholic Bioethics Center, ncbcenter.org. And they both have literature available online that can be helpful. And then for particular questions, they have a consultation function. You can request a consultation and they can have you speak with a medical moral expert to clarify particular issues. So that's what I would recommend.
Walt, thank you. I hope that that was helpful to you. We go now to Giovanni in Rhode Island, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Giovanni, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yeah, it's a follow-up from like the last 2 weeks. You said that the hardening of hearts was a hyperbole from the Old Testament authors. How do we know that the miracles of the Bible are not just exaggerated language or hyperbole, just like in the Old Testament?
Okay. Well, so it's a question that has to be faced. I mean, we do know that humans, and this is not just in the Bible, but all humans, use hyperbole and other literary modes of speech at times. So not everything that we're meant to, not everything that somebody says, either orally or in writing, is meant to be taken strictly literally. So we have to figure out which is the case in a given instance. And in English and in modern genres of literature and speech, we usually have a pretty good feel for what's meant to be literal and what's not. Although in some places like Twitter, you've got a lot of people saying stuff that at first glance sounds literal and vicious, and then they back off and say, oh, no, man, it was just a joke. So even today there can be questions about, well, did you mean that literally or were you joking or using some kind of figure of speech? That even comes up today. It certainly is going to come up when we look at ancient literature that was written in another language according to a set of conventions that we no longer use in writing literature today. So the question is going to come up in terms of how to tell. In one, I guess I would say a couple of things. The first one is we do have evidence for miracles that are reported in the Bible being genuine. The A number one exhibit to my mind is the resurrection of Christ. That is not meant metaphorically, and we have good evidence that that happened. If you want to read some of that evidence, you could check out my book, A Daily Defense, where I have quite a number of entries that go into the evidence for Jesus's resurrection. So that gives us one miracle that is very well supported by evidence and is in Scripture, and that shows us, okay, at least some of the miracles reported in Scripture are definitely literally true. They're not just symbols of something else. And from that knowledge, we can then broaden out and say, well, okay, the resurrection of Christ is reported in the Gospels, and those are historical type documents. They're not primarily prophetic documents, so they're not going to have as much symbolism in them as a prophetic book would. They're primarily composed of historical narratives. The resurrection is reported in a historical narrative. The resurrection is the big miracle that Jesus's entire ministry has been building up to. So if we know Jesus performed the big miracle, as reported in a reliable historical narrative, then that would give us confidence to say, okay, well, then these other miracles that are reported of Jesus, like, you know, the healing of a blind man or the curing of a deaf man or the exorcism of a possessed person, those also are reported in the same historical narrative in connection with Jesus. He's the one performing them or authorizing other people to perform them. And if this historical narrative is right when it reports the big miracle being performed by Jesus, then that gives us confidence that these lesser miracles are also genuinely performed by Jesus. If I can trust it for the big one, I can trust it for the littler ones too. Now, that doesn't answer every question one might have about miracles in the Bible. And, you know, if we were reading a book that is highly symbolic, there would be more of a question. But when we're dealing with straightforward historical narratives, especially in the Gospels, we have a special reason to say, yep, those miracles, Jesus really did do those. And that gives us broader confidence about the Bible in general when it reports miracles.
Thank you very much for that call, Giovanni. Appreciate it. This is Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, 888-318-7884. Let's go to George, watching on Catholic.com. You got the little pop-up video there on Catholic.com. George, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it so much. I got to say, first and foremost, apologies for the background noise. I'm outside and boy, is it windy, but I just got to say thank you so much for what you do. You know, a lot of kids my age, they look up to Kanye or, you know, whatever other celebrities. And, you know, I tell them names like Jimmy Akin or Trent Horn and they're like, huh, who's that?
But my publicist isn't really as good as Kanye's,
but his sneakers are way better.
Yeah. But no, I guess my question is, it's pretty, by the way, Mr. Akins, I just recently bought your, apologetics intro to apologetics on, I forgot the title. It was
School of Apologetics. School of Apologetics.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Right. Yeah.
George, I appreciate the ad. I need you to get to a question if you could, just because we'll run up against a break and we won't be able to get you an answer because we're only a couple minutes from that break. So, George, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Of course. I've got to say, I have to ask really for advice because, man, is my generation in a pickle. You know, I'm about to enter college and I just, you know, I know it's a broad question, but what pointers do you have for kids my age, you know, entering into the world of apologetics?
Well, you've already done the first thing that I would recommend, which is get a copy of the Beginning Apologetics course and go through that, because all of the particulars, or at least the great majority of the particulars that I would have for a person who's just going into college and is interested in apologetics, are going to be found in that course. In terms of things that that I would stress in particular, I mean, number one, be charitable. Absorb the golden rule. And if you, in interacting with people, would not want yourself to be treated a given way, do not treat other people that way. Also, be precise in your apologetics. Don't just assume that a text means what you want it to mean or that it supports a position. Be really careful and really precise with how you handle texts and how you handle arguments. Read the entire catechism from front to back. Make sure you have, in other words, a good grasp of the Catholic faith. And be aware that there's a difference between common ideas you hear in the Catholic Church and actual church teaching. I have a whole book called Teaching with Authority that goes into that subject. But be aware that ideas you know that people have, they may be perfectly acceptable ideas. They may even be true ideas, but that doesn't make them church teaching. Also, I would say read the Bible all the way through. I'd start with the catechism so that you have the right lens through which to read the Bible. But I'd say read the catechism first, read the Bible all the way through. And there are also various books and other resources about, you know, how to keep your faith in college, how to deal with anti-Christian and anti-Catholic professors, how to deal with specific charges that you may come across in college classes, you know, like, you know, the Inquisition. Well, that was obviously a horrible thing, they'll say, and Catholics today have some kind of guilt that still attaches to them because of it, or the Crusades or things like that. Well, you know, there have been mistakes committed in history. That doesn't mean Catholics today are guilty of them. It just means that some people in the past did some stuff they shouldn't have. And there are other sides to those stories. It's not all one way. So in looking at history, we want to acknowledge both the good and the bad and not focus on one to the exclusion of the other. We need to be honest about history, which contains both good and bad. And that means knowing the good and the bad. So as you pursue your college studies, you are likely to encounter things like that. Obviously, at Catholic.com, we have a lot of resources that can help you with things like that. You're also welcome to call back here on the show whenever we can be of assistance. But I would suggest pursuing some of those resources. And also, I would be somewhat slow to speak in college. When you're in college, your purpose is to get an education to set you in good stead for later in life, so that you can, for example, get a good job and you know, marry and raise a family and be able to support your family. Those are important life goals, and you need to keep those in mind, or, you know, unless you're going to the priesthood or a monastery or something, you need to keep these life goals in mind. And that means that there will be times in college where you may need to keep your mouth shut. Because you could encounter colleges, can, depending on the college you go to, it could be one that's quite hostile to Catholicism or to Christianity more generally. There's a lot of craziness in the college world right now. There was when I went through college, and it's even worse today. And so it's more important to keep your life goals on track than to win an argument in a particular class. And so there can be a lot of situations where my recommendation to someone in a classroom setting is keep your mouth shut, get your degree, and pursue your life goals. And once you're graduated, you'll have more liberty to be able to engage on various issues than you may have in class. That's not to say don't do anything in class and never give pushback, but be prudent about how you do it. And remember, the fundamental purpose of being in college is not to win arguments in a class, but to be able to achieve your broader life goals.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate the call. And it's actually just very encouraging to get your call, George. So I hope you will call back many more times. It's great to get a chance to talk with you. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Open Forum. And right now, Jimmy Akin has the cover story on Thomas Aquinas and the occults on Catholic Answers Magazine. And that's the kind of high quality stuff you get there. As a matter of fact, I can never remember, and I have opened many, I can never remember opening an issue of Catholic Answers Magazine and not finding articles that I wanted to read, new things that I learned, a take that I had never heard before on scripture or on apologetics question. It's just there's just a wealth of new, interesting stuff each time the issue comes out, often on very ancient questions, but with the twist of the contemporary apologist on answering those questions. I think you'll really enjoy it if you get the magazine, and I think right now is the time to get it, because you get 25% off the cover price if you do a 1-year subscription right now. And they include the free digital subscription and a bunch of free download files with all the digital issues from the past 4 years. So that's more and more value getting added onto what you're getting at 25% off. Or you can do a 2-year subscription and get 40% off the cover price, 40% off with a 2-year subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine right now. And you also get the free digital subscription, free downloads. But that's for the past 8 years of issues. All kinds of great stuff in there. Catholic Answers Magazine is the place to go to, CatholicAnswersMagazine.com is the place to go to make, to get your subscription. 25% off on a 1-year subscription right now, 40% off on a 2-year subscription, CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
The greatest joy in my life is helping others to come to know Christ more fully. And there's no better light on this path, the path to deep union with God, than the wisdom of the saints. Talking about this daily on EWTN Radio is one of the great joys of my life.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
It's been a good show. It's been a good show so far. We've got Jimmy for another hour, but I can't say it's been a groovy show yet. I feel like there's a certain grooviness missing thus far. It's Thursday. It's open forum. Usually a little grooviness finds its way into the show. So we'll look forward to that as we go on. 888-318-7884. Our number, 888-318-7884. Up next for Jimmy, Terry in Anderson, South Carolina, listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Terry, your question for Jimmy.
Well, first of all, I know I'm late, but congratulations and best wishes to Assistant Maria for her upcoming marriage.
Hey, so, you're not late. You're right on time. Have you read Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, yet?
I have that book in my possession already.
Oh, okay. What about Secrets from Heaven, Father Sebastian Walsh's book? Have you read that one?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so hang on the line after you talk with Jimmy, and we'll get your address, and Marie will send you your free copy because you remembered, Terry. You're the first one today to remember, so good for you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Jimmy, first of all, thank you for all you do. It's awesome. My question is, how can a all-knowing, loving, just God and Father create someone that he knows will not accept him and be banished from him from eternity? I can't wrap my mind around that.
Well, there are different answers to this question that have been proposed. One answer is that God desires the salvation of everybody. So if somebody is not saved, it's because God tolerates that person's decision. He's given that person free will. He's going to respect that person's free will. And he's only tolerating their misuse of the free will to say, I don't want to be with you forever. In terms of why would he tolerate that, there are different answers that have been proposed. One answer is that God tolerates the rejection that some people give him because by tolerating that rejection, it allows the existence of evil people in the world, and the evil people will create evil situations that God can bring good out of. And that's something we know is true up to a point, because as the Catechism says, God would not tolerate any evil if he didn't have a way to bring good out of it. So some people have said, well, God tolerates the loss of souls in order to tolerate evil people who create evil situations that he can bring good out of, such as giving holy people the opportunity to develop in virtue. And the argument is the holy people wouldn't develop in virtue in the way that they otherwise would if they didn't have evil to deal with in their lives. So that's one answer that's been proposed. It's not my personal favorite, but it is one answer. Another answer that has been proposed is this. If you talk about the kind of knowledge that God has, historically, everybody has agreed that God has at least two types of knowledge. The first type of knowledge is his knowledge of everything that's possible. Because he's infinitely smart. He doesn't actually calculate because he's outside of time, but figuratively speaking, God can calculate every single possibility that ever could exist in any possible world. So God knows everything that's possible. Also, by what's called his knowledge of vision, God sees everything that's actual. So you know, he's outside of time, he sees all of history, and therefore he knows everything that's actual in addition to knowing everything that's possible. Now, some people have proposed that God may have a third kind of knowledge that is kind of midway between knowing the possible and knowing the actual, and so they call this middle knowledge. The idea behind middle knowledge is God knows what someone would freely choose to do, even in a situation that that they're never put in. So God would know, if I put this person in this situation, here's what they'd freely choose to do. And if God has middle knowledge, then this, and the church doesn't teach that he does, it's a theological opinion that was not shared, for example, by like St. Thomas Aquinas. He thought God had the two kinds of knowledge, but not middle knowledge. Well, if God had middle knowledge, it kind of makes this question harder, because God could say, well, I know that if I created this person, they would choose against me and go to hell, and therefore God could refrain, since he'd know that in advance, so to speak, he could refrain from creating that person. But if God didn't have middle knowledge, if he just had what all theologians have historically understood, if he knew all possible things and all actual things, then in creating a person, he wouldn't know what that person would do prior to creating them. He'd just create the person in history, the person would make his choices, and God would simultaneously see those choices. But he wouldn't know, if I create this person, this is how the person's going to use their free will. He would just create the person and then let the person make their choices. So that's another possible thing that may be playing a role here. It's ultimately a mystery. We don't have the final answer on all this. But what we do know is that God wouldn't permit any evil, including the loss of a soul, unless there was an equal or greater good that he was going to bring out of it. And so from there, it's just a matter of doing the best we can to try to figure out what those goals might be. But as the Catechism acknowledges, we won't be able to know everything in this life about why God allows particular evils. We'll have to wait until the next life to have the answers to some of that explained to us.
Terry, hang on and talk with Marie, and she'll get you that book. And for those who don't know why Terry got the book, because it's the wedding month for Marie and David. And so the first person who calls and congratulates them each day gets a free book. And we got almost to the end of the first hour before somebody did. I know the other people, I'm sure, wished Marie well, but they didn't remember. Let's go now to Tom in Connecticut, listening on WMLK Veritas Catholic Radio. Tom, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. You guys are every single kind of awesome. My question is, in icons, you often see Jesus touching his thumb and either his ring finger or both his ring finger. I was wondering what if that gesture has a name, what the meaning is, and would be suitable for a greeting now that we're doing this social distancing.
Okay. So we're going to hit the top of the hour, so let me go through this quickly. Yes, in icons you will, particularly Greek icons, you will see Jesus making a kind of gesture with his right hand where he touches his thumb to his ring finger of his right hand. That's the third finger. And this is used by priests as a blessing. in Greek liturgies. And so this is a gesture of blessing. That's what Jesus is doing in the image, is he's blessing people. It has various meanings attributed to it. One of the things you will notice, and I'm going to have to make it real quick, but it's the way the hand is shaped, it makes the letters ICXC, which in Greek would be Jesus Christus. It's the first and last letters of Jesus Christ in Greek. And also the three fingers are held to symbolize the Trinity in some versions of this.
Well, you did do it, Jimmy. You did it quickly. Thanks so much for the call. I appreciate that, Tom. You're listening to Catholic Answers Live, open forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest. And we're going to do another hour with Jimmy right after this. 888-318-7884.